All right, for our next talk, Dr. Anna Miller will tell us a little bit about pelvic fracture patterns and the importance of looking for associated injuries and how that might give us a clue as to what we might be dealing with just based on the imaging that we see in the trauma bay by itself. Thanks.
Thanks, Todd, for having me, and thank you guys all for making it out late in the day. So I'm Anna Miller. I'm the Chief of Orthopedic Trauma at Washington University, and I'm going to be talking, as he said, about pelvic trauma, distinguishing fracture types and management of associated injuries with an asterisk, that is, an orthopedic surgeon's perspective. And I know some of you guys might be thinking, we know your perspective, there is a fracture, but there's actually recent literature that we're smarter than you might have previously thought. So hopefully I can offer a couple things. So no disclosures that are relevant to this talk. My goals are for you guys to understand pelvic fracture injury patterns a little bit more. Dr. Biffle talked about this some. Specifically to clarify pelvis versus acetabulum, to discuss our shared goals of acute management, and then to understand how other interventions affect future outcomes for pelvic fracture patients. So classification. We focus a lot on the x-rays, as you guys know. This is just some examples of kind of what we're looking for. We really want the spine to line up with the symphysis and the tip of the sacrum to touch the top of the symphysis on a good AP. Obviously, this is not always possible in the trauma bay or with a really bad pelvis fracture, but we try to get them lined up. And then we also have rules for our inlet views, not really tilted enough, not overlapping well, versus a good inlet view, an outlet view where you can actually not really see the sacrum on this versus one where you're really getting a good tilt. So yes, we have all these rules, but who really cares? Just the orthopedic surgeons. So the reason is that these are the only views that actually will tell us what's posterior, what's anterior, what's cranial, and what's caudal. And for us, that's really important because obviously it affects how we fix the patient, but we also have to think about the associated injuries. So we see a patient like this, and we know there's going to be a problem. The patient's obviously wide open. They need a sheet or something to compress the pelvis, as Dr. Biffle went over. But if you look closely, they also have an injury to both the SI joints, actually. And in this case, they're a little bit caudal. And as we all know, the most important things are not the bone. It's what's inside the bone. And when the bone goes caudal, these things go with it. So we actually really care about the direction of displacement and how that affects what's going on around the bone and with all the soft tissues and what we can do to help with that. So our shared goals: stabilize the patient as rapidly as possible. As Dr. Biffle talked about, we like to get them in a sheet. And I think this is important to have some early diagnosis of pelvic instability. So if you look at the old ATLS guidelines, this is actually part of the ABCs. So the C is circulation, as you all know. And we should actually be able to diagnose an unstable pelvis when you're doing your primary survey of the patient during the ABCs. So I'm just going to take a moment, if you guys will bear with me. I would like everybody in the audience to put your hands on your hips, the iliac crest. I know it's asking a lot. I won't ask you to do it to your neighbor. But put your hands on your hips and push as hard as you can. So that is what a normal, stable pelvis feels like. And I want you guys to all, I hope, if anybody felt movement, just come talk to me afterwards. So when you feel that, it's really, really, really solid. And I'm telling you this because when you feel a pelvis that looks like the one I just showed that's wide open, it doesn't feel as obvious as you might think. So it just feels like a little bit squishy. It doesn't feel like yours. So when you feel the slightest bit of squishiness, that person needs a sheet, that person may need resuscitation. So really keep that in mind. And again, compression is what we want. Nobody should be actually pulling the pelvis open to make it bleed more. So just compression, a little mushiness. And you shouldn't need to wait for the x-ray to diagnose it. And certainly should not delay for a CT scan unless you have very expedited CT in your center. This is actually part of our new imaging guidelines that are coming out from the Committee on Trauma. So really an x-ray is the gold standard still for early diagnosis of this. The other thing that you can consider is even having a sheet ready in your trauma bay. So when a patient gets log rolled, you take the spine board out if they still have one, feel it, and if it's mushy, you can wrap them right up. So think about getting them stabilized as rapidly as possible. Wrap and squeeze. So This is just an example of how great a sheet can make a patient look. So this patient has a really unstable pelvis similar to the one I just showed. You can see they also have a hip dislocation. So the sheet will not help the hip dislocation that had to be reduced manually. But then once the patient is reduced and in a sheet, you can hardly even tell that they had that really unstable pelvis. So these sheets or binders can really, really do a great job for the patient. So I want to go a little bit into the pelvis not equal acetabulum idea. And the reason for this is that we know certain acetabular fractures in particular are very confusing because they can look like they're a pelvis problem. But a pelvis is really what we're talking about in this session, hemodynamic instability. It can cause a patient to die. And acetabulum, as much as we orthopedic surgeons like to get excited about it, is really just another joint. They're probably just going to get some arthritis if it doesn't get fixed promptly most of the time. So we like to come up with these really complex classifications that nobody can remember. There are all these little parts to it, but it's not going to be life-threatening. So this is an example of a patient that was diagnosed originally with a pelvis fracture, but is actually an acetabular fracture. And everybody can kind of see why. On first glance, there's something crazy going on. The whole pelvis looks kind of tilted and shifted, and it certainly doesn't look good. But when you really take a look at it, so this is a 3D reconstruction, this is like the outlet view. If you look at it, the spine lines up with the symphysis, the iliac crests are pretty even, there's no overall instability of the pelvis, that hip socket is just crunched in a little bit. And if you look at the inlet equivalent, it's kind of the same thing. The rest of the pelvic ring is intact, and really it's just this area around the acetabulum that's broken. So rarely these can cause bleeding problems, especially if they go into the notch, but most of the time it just needs a little traction and fixation at a later date once the patient is stable. So just a little more about the pelvis classification, and again, I know Dr. Biffle talked about this some, but I want to just talk about some of the classifications that we look at. There are a lot of different ways pelvises can be classified, and by the way, it is pelvises or pelvis. There's no such thing as pelvi, in case you were wondering. So anatomical stability, deformity, all these people have described things with their names on them, but I think the most important thing is the pelvis stable or unstable, and is the patient stable or unstable? So that's really what we think about. And we talked about this a little bit with the Young and Burgess, but there are three types. So there's lateral compression, which is very well named. It is compression from the side and usually causes kind of an internal rotation of the pelvis, decreasing the volume and therefore usually not causing a lot of arterial bleeding, as was mentioned. The anterior-posterior compression may be the worst name of any injury. It doesn't make any sense really, but if you think about the vector, it is from anterior, but it actually widens the pelvis. So this is really confusing to a lot of people. We call it an open book type, but it's an APC, which is some injury from the front that splits the pelvis open. Again, more highly associated with bleeding. And then that vertical shear type, and this is where it's a lot easier to tell with one of the outlet views if you have some shift in the cranial or caudal direction. And again, if it's cranial, you're kind of shortening the vessels. If it's caudal, we're really worried about those vessels being injured. You can also have combined mechanism. I'll tell you, I don't think any group of orthopedic surgeons could ever agree what the classification of this one on the right side of the screen is, but everybody knows there's something wrong with that patient. So pelvic fractures and hemorrhage, Young and Burgess were the first to show that these fracture patterns are associated with vascular injury risk, especially the APC and vertical shear. They are the injury patterns that are tensile to neurovascular structure, so it just makes sense. And I would just highlight the last bullet about iliac wing fractures with greater sciatic notch extension. So that's where the gluteal artery comes through. Those are the ones that we do see, especially with an acetabular fracture that goes into the notch. May have more bleeding, or any of the pelvis fracture patterns that have the fracture into the notch can have more bleeding. So just a few minutes about associated injuries. Open fractures I really want to highlight because they are uncommon but very, very high mortality, up to 50%, and it's important to have a high index of suspicion. As you can see here, they can be very hard to find if you're not looking for them. And it's very, very important for us, if they do have an open wound, especially going into the colon, rectum, or perineum, to think about early diverting colostomy. Of course, that is usually our general surgery colleagues that are doing that. But for our pelvis hardware fixation, if we don't have that, then we have almost a 100% infection rate of pelvis hardware later. So if you have that conversation with your colleagues, it's really important depending on what they're planning to do for the pelvis. Also very important to have early repair of vaginal lacerations. They've shown that there are subsequent pelvic abscesses that are more common if the vagina is not repaired. And patients, sorry, this is sticking now, with very large wounds need to have aggressive debridement. Again, they have a very high rate of infection if they're not. So this leads me to urologic injuries, which are also very common with pelvic rings. So this is a patient we had that had a bladder injury. As you can see, there's a lot of extravasation out of the bladder. But if you look at the entire pelvis, you start to see that there's actually contrast going over the ileum. And it actually tracked all the way down the leg and then out the side of the leg. So this patient originally was diagnosed with just an open leg wound, but it turns out it was an open pelvis fracture tracking all the way from the bladder out the side of the leg. So again, high index of suspicion. So urologic injuries are about 5 to 10% incidence more with males than females with pelvic injuries, and for each millimeter of symphysis diastasis or inframedial pubic bone fracture displacement, they have a 10% increased risk of a urethral injury. So when we see these patients with a widened symphysis, or some of the ones that we've shown, they almost have a 100% chance of having a urethral injury. So really, really important to keep a close eye on these patients and make sure that's being assessed by any of the teams that are taking care of them. Most of the patients do have blood at the meatus, or they may have a high rating prostate. There's a very high incidence for us of infection if they have hardware placed in patients with extraperitoneal bladder injuries. So that's why a lot of times, even though we ask our colleagues and they say they would not repair an extraperitoneal bladder injury on its own, we request that it gets fixed so that it doesn't later infect the pelvic hardware. So if they don't need hardware near where the bladder is injured, they may not need it fixed, but for us, if we especially have to do a symphyseal plating, it's very high risk of infection. There's also a very high risk of infection with suprapubic catheters, especially the closer they are to our incision. So again, if a conversation can happen between orthopedics and urology or general surgery before these things are placed, it can be really, really helpful. There was actually a recent study that just came out this last year that used NTDB data and showed there was not an increased risk of infection with suprapubic catheters and pelvis hardware placement, but it's NTDB data, so there are no long-term outcomes, and I think if you do follow these patients long-term, as we often do, you may see that increased incidence coming later. So just a couple other points. I'd like to just mention consideration for transfer. So we in Missouri, and I don't know if this is true in other states, but we see a lot of patients that were seen at a smaller, not level trauma center and treated for a pelvic ring injury and then show up in my clinic 6 months or 9 months later with this horrible, distorted, non-union, malunion, haven't been able to walk all this time. And it's because some of these little things were missed. So if you do see posterior pelvic instability, so you have a complete fracture in the back of the pelvis, bladder, urethral injuries, open pelvic fractures, some kind of lateral directed force with a fracture through the notch like we talked about, or a widened APC with anterior displacement more than 2.5 centimeters, I would really consider getting them to a pelvic orthopedic specialist if you don't have one at your center. And then the final little note, and again, Dr. Biffle talked about this some, but it really, really does help if you have great relationships with your colleagues and you all talk about how to take care of these patients. This was a orthopedic study that showed that if they had a multidisciplinary pathway coordinating the resources, including joint decision making by trauma surgeons and orthopedic traumatologists, they improved patient survival. And the primary benefits were in reducing early deaths from exsanguination and late deaths from multiple organ failure, at least partially due to infections. So very important to have a team approach. So I hope you guys understand a little more about pelvic injury patterns, that the pelvis and the acetabulum are not the same. We have shared goals of acute management and understand how some of these other interventions may affect long-term outcomes for the pelvic patients. Thank you.